What I want to talk to you about is the process of making the Christmas lectures. Who actually saw the Christmas lectures? Good, this helps. It's held in a room which is not, in fact, unlike this in layout. It's got exactly the same sitting at the side, sitting in the middle, two aisles, but it goes up a lot more. It's much more raked, and it has a balcony around here. So in a way, this feels quite familiar. What I want to tell you about is some of the things that went wrong, some of the things that went right, the difference between what actually happens on the ground and what you see on your television screen. A lot of people have said things like, "It went very smoothly, didn't it? You never seem to forget anything." I forgot quite a few things. But by the time they finished editing it and fitted the retakes in, you can't tell. Other people said the children looked very interested. To be fair, they were, in fact. But they were there for 2 hours altogether by the time we got them into the place, done the recording, kept them there while we did a few retakes. And, of course, the bits you see are where the producers very carefully selected shots, cutaways of the children that, in one way or another are televisual. And in particular, if they look as if they're concentrating, they'll film them. And if two of them are having a fight in the corner somewhere, they won't. Furthermore, if I've forgotten something, or they want to edit in, if you're going to cut something in the middle, so to speak, sound's not a great problem, but vision is a big problem. It's absolutely clear you switch from one attempt to a different attempt. So what do? You cut the vision to a shot of the children in the audience, while the sound carries on behind it. Then you change to the other bit, different set of sound, and then finally you cut back to the second bit of the vision, and it all fits together beautifully. And that shot of the children was probably taken half an hour earlier. So, they grub around hunting through all the cutaways to find one that actually will patch in. And you end up saying things like, "We haven't used this one yet," and the like. So in fact, whenever you see the shot that cuts away to the kids, it may mean that that was a natural point to put it in, because every few minutes they want to do that. But it probably means that I made a mistake. So if you happen to have the tape of these things and view it again bearing that in mind, you get a more accurate picture. So let me step back to well before the whole thing started, and let me point something out to you. Clearly, when I get too far that way, I get a feedback. Here is a blow-up of a £20 note. And on the right-hand side of that, you see Michael Faraday. And on the left, you see somebody standing at a desk with a lot of Victorian-looking people in the background. Yeah, when this is over, get your £20 notes out, have a look. This is what you'll see in colour. Michael Faraday founded the Royal Institution Christmas Lectures. They were called Lectures for a Juvenile Auditory at the time. He founded them in 1826. So we're 171 years ago. And the lectures that have just happened were in fact the 168th. Because for 3 years during World War I, they weren't given. Every other year, regular as clockwork, the Christmas lectures have been given. Faraday gave 19 of the first 31. And he didn't, in fact, give the first one. He gave the second one. But he was the brains behind the whole thing. That lecture room is the lecture room that is still used for these lectures. It's been refurbished a bit. I'll show you a not very good picture of it in a minute. But it's the same lecture room. The desk at the front is basically the same desk. It's the same funny shape with this sort of U-shape cut away in the middle, which is known to all those who've ever lectured at it as the bite. Think bite as in Great Australian Bite. It's a bay. And you stand there, and in a sense that's a sign. If you stand there, here it is, This is a sign that you're about to say something terribly authoritative, and perhaps a sign that the whole lecture is about to go in a different direction. The Christmas lectures are something the BBC has televised them for a good many years now. They're very difficult to televise because the lecture room was actually built in 1801. And it wasn't designed for television. Here's what it looked like in 1855. Faraday is giving his Christmas lecture. It's still amazingly similar to that, but it doesn't have a fireplace behind it anymore. It has a wall with a projection screen, big screen across the top. And either side of that is a door, and I'll show you a rather scruffy plan of the whole. Okay, so this is drawn kind of from memory and at high speed about 10 minutes ago. Now, what we've got here, this is a plan view, and we've got a couple of doors. Normally, when this is being used for lectures rather than television, you have a couple of doors here and here for the audience to come in and out. There's a whole set of seats here, 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 two entrances here, two more entrances at the front, and a sort of U-shaped tunnel called the ambulatory. And as you go around this, there are lovely glass cases with all sorts of wonderful historical scientific devices and gadgets, and this is what so-and-so used in the lecture of 1847 and so forth in there. And then above the ambulatory is a second-tier kind of gallery of seats. The whole thing now holds just over 400, about 450 people. Originally it held 900, but it's been a little bit redesigned. However, for television purposes, most of those entrances are in use. That entrance becomes the projection screen. There's a screen, it would be about here, and behind it, about 8 feet out, sitting out there, is a projector. Okay, so there's a projection screen, that's one door gone. That door is completely occupied by a TV camera, whose job is largely to show the lecturer standing by the projector. This passageway is occupied by another TV camera. Up here, just in among the audience, taking up about 7 or 8 seats, is yet another TV camera. Somewhere up there are two cameras, one of which does close-ups, and one of which just does a kind of overall shot of the whole thing from some point up, right up near the ceiling, which when you've got hair like mine is a little nasty, most unfair. It's sort of vertical shot makes you look like a monk. Okay, and then there's also another cameraman with a camera on his shoulder who kind of wanders around. For example, when we had the tiger in there, he was, you know, the sort of tiger was about here, this tiger cub, and he would be somewhere about here with his camera like this. All this is going on around you. There's about 450 people in the audience, and you're trying to give a lecture. It's quite fun. Notice all the cameras are on one side. They're all looking pretty much the other way. This has a whole pile of implications. Firstly, the cameras cannot see each other. And television people are very unhappy if you see a camera in a shot. So they put them all on one side, so there's no possible way they could see each other. Just occasionally you could have seen perhaps the bloke with the portable one, but they try and edit that out. Secondly, it means only the audience sitting on that side ever get to be on television. In fact, only the audience up to about halfway ever get to be on television. Two reasons for that. Firstly, that's where they put all the kids. Your audience consists of probably two-thirds children, but the other third is parents and anybody else who wants to come along, and, you know, my wife at one point, and all this kind of thing, and the lady from Japan who was checking it out to see whether they wanted to do it again in August, which in fact is what we're going to do. So the regulars know this. The kids who know about it fight for those seats. Okay? They know. If you watch, you'll start to see the same faces over and over again. And it's not just because it's the same kids coming, but it's because those kids know where to sit. Okay. So, seats. Now, we've blocked up that entrance, we've blocked up that entrance, we've blocked up this entrance. That one, everyone comes in through and goes out by, and it's shut during the lecture. That leaves two entrances over here. Now, there's a whole pile of demonstrations on trolleys that have to come in and out. In fact, almost the most difficult part of the logistics is getting these trolleys in and out. The trolleys live in the ambulatory. Well, they live in about half of it. The other half is occupied by the BBC with lots of its strange equipment, and there's a gadget that stores slides for projection on the screen. It's about the size of a large wardrobe. It's very out of date, but it works. And they use this because they're happy with it, and it sits there. And you kind of program the slides in. So that lives about here somewhere. But here, it's just masses and masses of trolleys. Not only the trolleys for the particular lecture you're giving, but in practice, trolleys for all the previous lectures and all the lectures that are going to follow. All of the stuff that comes on and goes out is stuck in the ambulatory. It's wonderful wandering around it in the middle of the process. You start to wander around and think, oh, look, there's the rabbits we used in the first lecture. Oh, gosh, now what's happened to that? Someone sat on it. And so forth. There's just piles and piles of junk all piled in there because there's nowhere else to put it. But also in there, either side of this entrance, in order, roughly, are the various trolleys and demos that are going to come in and out. And there are two people at the Royal Institution, Ilya and Bipin, whose job is to bring it in, take it off again. And so there's a kind of rhythm that sets into giving the lectures, which roughly speaking is like this. I'm sitting here spouting away about something. And mostly what's going through my mind at this point is, can I remember what the heck is coming next? And there are clues, but the main clue is Ilya and Bipin are waiting with it, just tucked in down here somewhere where you can't see them, but I can see them. And so if I'm not sure what's happening, I look over there and I see what they're about to bring on. And this reminds me, mostly, of what I'm supposed to be talking about. Some of the biggest problems were when I knew something was coming on. I knew it was over there. And I looked to see what it was going to be because I couldn't remember. And it wasn't there. Because for some reason there was a bit of a snarl up. The logistics are so difficult. These trolleys only just fit in quite narrow passageways. So just occasionally when I looked, it wasn't there. So if you see me suddenly looking completely perplexed and whatever, that was what was happening. The lectures were recorded, the jargon is, as live. That word as conceals quite a lot. As live means the lecturer's job, target, is to give a connected one-hour lecture, exactly as if the whole thing was just going to be filmed and shown. But the as live means that after you've done that, any little glitches, any problems, anything that didn't quite work, that's possible. It's possible to retake that, but you save it all up for the end. You don't stop the lecturer in the middle, except on two occasions, actually, and I'll tell you what happened when we stopped in the middle on those two occasions. The process of doing these lectures goes back quite a long way. I was stopped by my neighbour in the street a couple of days ago. He said, did it take a long time to prepare for that? So I said, well, you know, 3 months intensive and then quite a bit before that. And I brought my diary along to remind me. It really started about 2 years ago when I was first asked to give the lectures, but what they had in mind was the lectures for 1996, not 1997. As it turned out, I couldn't do that because I wasn't even going to be in the country at the time. That does make it difficult. So they said, OK, do them a year later. That's where this book came from. I'm I believe, the only Christmas lecturer who has ever produced the book at the same time as the lectures. And that's mostly because nobody else was warned sufficiently long in advance that they were going to be doing the things to be able to write the book. This was, of course, a very interesting challenge for the publishers, who had to produce it pretty fast, and also one they couldn't possibly resist because media tie-in book. How can you possibly miss the chance? I was thinking of my diary. Apart from that particular being asked about 2 years ahead, roughly a year ahead, we hit a bit of a crisis, which was that the Department of Trade and Industry had just noticed that 1997 was the year of engineering success. And they suddenly got it into their heads, wouldn't it be nice to have an engineer giving the Christmas lectures? And the fact they'd already invited a mathematician didn't really seem to be a great obstacle to the DTI, whose view was, well, we boot the mathematician out and we bring in an engineer instead. So we had various discussions with them and pointed out there was a book coming and contracts had been signed. And finally, it was pointed out to them that if they really wanted to do this, they could, but it would cost them a lot of money. And at that point, they shut up completely, and we never heard another word from them. So that was quite interesting. Looking at my diary, the first actual meeting related to the lectures was on the 16th of July. And that was a meeting with the BBC to try and just generally get to know each other and start to plan out what the lectures might consist of. The next one's about 2 weeks later. Then there's a big gap in September with nothing much at all. 15th of September, 16th of September, I'm down at the BBC. But I'm not talking about the lectures, I'm talking about the booklet. There is a BBC booklet, 32 pages colour booklet. The lecturer has to write this. You have to write that before you give the lectures. In fact, you're so busy writing this that you can't actually spend any time preparing the lectures at all. There's about 1 month when that's all you can do. So first you write the book before you know what's in the lectures. So the book is full of all the things I thought might go in. Then you write the booklet, which is full of what we thought at the time would go in the lectures. But if you look closely at the booklet, there are a few items in it that never appeared on screen. And there are several things on screen that are nowhere referred to in the booklet. Nonetheless, it's close. It's about as close as we could get. Then you think, great, now we're going to start doing the scripting of the lectures. Hold it. No, there's the pre-publicity. There's writing the article for The Telegraph. There's doing the interview for The Guardian. There's Blue Peter. 3 minutes live on Blue Peter. You spend the entire afternoon rehearsing for your 3 minutes. There were something like 11 radio broadcasts, 5 things for newspapers and about 3 things for television, including the Sky Book Show, all of which were happening during the period when what I wanted to do was sit down and write the script. But, of course, you can't do that. So now you're sitting there thinking, this is fantastic. We've got the book, we've got the booklet, we have publicised this thing to the hilt, and we still don't really know what's in it. And if something funny happens now, think of all, you know, we've built up all these expectations. There's more and more riding on this, and you haven't really yet got to the real thing. Okay, so now we're beginning to get to the real thing. We are having script conferences. Now, script is an interesting concept for these lectures. You won't see me reading from a script. You can't use auto cue. You can't just look at the camera like the newsreader does and read it off the box at the front, because this is a lecture. On television, I must look as if I'm talking to the audience. I can't look as if I'm looking at the camera. If I'm looking at the camera, that means I'm addressing the audience at home, but it should be the audience in the lecture room. So I can't use auto cue. So I don't have to learn the script, but I have to have a pretty good idea what's in it and kind of make it up as I go along within the range of these things. Okay, scripts begin something like that. This is the producer's attempt at mapping out, in fact, the first lecture, and it's full of various things: Kepler, orbits, ellipses, cannonball, dot, dot, dot. It was an attempt to write down a list of the different things that would happen in sequence and roughly what was going on. As you can see, the whole idea breaks down about 3 lines down. and he ends up scrawling things all over it. But nonetheless, you know, this is 2 hours, him and me sitting in the office trying to work out what to do, and ends up looking like that. That then turns into something more like this. This is my attempt to write down some words that go around what we discussed as possible content. Doesn't look like that for very long. Producer prefers it like this. He's broken it up into bits and pieces again, but it does look quite neat and tidy. After rehearsals, it looks like this. This was a script. This was my script. Now, the way they do these things is there are 5 lectures and they're recorded over 10 days. Day 1, rehearse lecture 1. Rehearse, the word used, phrase you use for it is stagger through. Item by item, go through it, work out the camera angles, find out what goes wrong, try and put it right. Takes all day. It's not really a coherent run through anything, and it's often done with most of the bits and pieces we want missing. For example, I remember vividly when we were rehearsing the last lecture, which involves a tiger, that the role of the tiger was played by a small stuffed toy cat, which is all we had. And the tank with angelfish in it was a cardboard box, and somebody taped a drawing of a fish on the front. And so you're rehearsing with this. Then the next day, morning is a dress rehearsal, which is, you know, anyone in amateur, it's really like an amateur dramatics dress rehearsal. You try and do it all non-stop, but things go wrong. For example, we had a dripping tap, which was supposed to sit there, and the tap was there to demonstrate chaos. It was supposed to drip gently and go regular drip, 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 and then I turned it a little bit, and it went drippity, drippity, drip, 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 very randomly. Okay. In the final lecture, that actually worked. In the dress rehearsal, the hose kept falling off, and we had water all over the floor. Then once we got the hose properly clipped on, it turned out to be impossible to set the tap so that it dripped in these 2 ways. The most difficult thing was getting it dripping regularly to begin with. Once we got that, you just nudged it a little bit, and it usually worked. For the actual lecture, which is always in the afternoon, follows pretty hard on the heels of the dress rehearsal, we decided how to do that. We set it up dripping at the beginning of the lecture. Bipin spent about 15 minutes fiddling with it until it was going drip, drip, drip steadily, and then we left it like that. So it's there for the whole of the first few minutes of the lecture, dripping away. Not because we really wanted that, but because that was the only way to do it. And round the back of the desk, it was still very wet underfoot from all the water that had splashed out. So anyway, that's so scripts. After the dress rehearsal, scripts, well, after the rehearsal, scripts look like this. It's full of a parsnip here. It's a parsnip was a rabbit. Parsnip came out of a hat. Biffin was in the trolley underneath the hat. The hat had 2 purposes. Parsnip the rabbit came out, then a whole pile of stuffed rabbits came out to demonstrate Fibonacci numbers. Biffin was a little unhappy sitting underneath a rabbit. Especially the rabbit got a bit nervous. So we had to put a lid in for the rabbit to sit on. And then once the live rabbit had safely been removed, Bibby could then start to push up the stuffed rabbits. In the event, Parsnip performed beautifully and did exactly what he was supposed to do, which was hop around a bit, and didn't disgrace himself in any way whatsoever, which was nice. So Parsnip did his job beautifully. Biffin, on the other hand, particularly at rehearsal, had a habit of stuffing the rabbits up a bit too quickly. So I'm sitting there with about to take this rabbit out of magician's hat, and the rabbit rises out of the hat of its own accord. Now, anyway, you iron those out. We got panics. Panics can come from anywhere. The graphics man had designed and drawn a schematic picture of a beating heart, and I was trying to make the point that the electrical waves on a normal heart are essentially expanding circles, but on a defective heart they can be spirals. Somebody at the BBC had been looking up some web page and had read that normal heart waves are spirals. Big panic. What are they? The only actual source, my memory was the version I've just given you, but the web page said spirals. And eventually we dug out a book and I faxed to them this picture of a beating rabbit heart, which actually shows a little circle there at the top, which is then spreading out. So we knew, in fact, it was like that. Other thing that happens after rehearsals, your script starts to look like this. Here was a great idea. We'd flagged it, though, as a possible place to cut. We got about 15 seconds into trying to do it at rehearsal and thought, no, definitely not. This is too complicated, it's going to take up too much time, it doesn't really work, we've already made the point. Scrub it. So it gets scrubbed. By the time we come to the actual shooting of the programme, everybody else's scripts look rather like this. They're divided up item by item. They've been put in FileMaker Pro, I think it is, which is one of these pieces of software that lets you do this. And they're just telling everyone, which item is it, what's it involve, who's responsible for it, and what's the order. That's their script. Mine looks more like this. I've written, mostly for my own benefit, a series of statements about what sort of things I should put in, what sort of things I should remember not to do, what the producer has told me they want, where we're going next. It's all colour-coded. If it's using kids, it's pink. If it's big change, it's a green stripe across there. I ended up sitting in the hotel about 10 o'clock at night till midnight, preparing a script like this. Now, the entire purpose of preparing this script is, when I've done this, I'm really happy I got this script in a form that I can use, and it's about 18 pages of this stuff, about 60 items, and it sits at the side of the desk, in view of the cameras, in some shots, but it basically just sits there. And because I spent 2 hours the previous night writing this thing out, carefully colour-coding it, and generally going over it in this way, I don't actually need it. But I feel confident that I don't need it because it's there. And I always know, if I've got any problems, I can go back and look at that script. So it's a kind of summary of all sorts of different things you have to remember. While I'm at it, let's put up a picture. There is the actual lecture room. You can see what I mean by it's a bit like this. Okay, it's the same sort of thing, but much, much higher. Okay. So what actually happens in practice? And how does it differ from what you see on the screen? Okay, let me tell you a couple of the things that didn't really work. The first one is when the lecturer gets it wrong. And the first lecture you give, you're so nervous that you pretty much get it right. Second lecture, you're now confident you can get it right, and so you make mistakes. By the third lecture, you know you're going to make mistakes, and you also know they're going to be edited out again. So it goes something like this. I've worked out what the next demonstration is. I'm probably standing here talking about something that's come up on the screen. And then, roughly speaking, there's a rule, which is, if something comes up on the screen, stand by the screen and talk to the screen. And then if there's a demonstration, walk round the front like this, and out comes the demonstration, and bring down volunteers from the kit. And every kid in the room volunteers. They're very good at volunteering. So you try and choose ones you haven't used before. Normally they're not rehearsed. These are quite genuine, fresh volunteers. Bring them down, and you do the thing. So little Fred comes down, and Fred's got a chaos double pendulum to play with, and he plays with this pendulum, and it all works great. And then I say, okay, thank you, Fred, back to your seat. Now, hold up, oh, wait. Hang on. What have I forgotten? Pick up script, shuffle through 6 pages till I get to where I am. Oh, right, yes. Fred, can you come down again, please? Right. Underneath that trolley was the next demonstration I was supposed to do, but I'd forgotten it was there, because it wasn't in view on top. I'd forgotten all about it. Okay. So then Fred comes down again, and we redo the last bit of Fred playing with the chaos pendulum. And I say, now, just wait there, Fred, because we've got another one for you. And he plays with it. We have this wonderful gel thing that you stir it up and it all gets completely mixed up. And then you wind it backwards and it unstirs itself. It's a bit like you sort of start with a meringue and unbeat it and end up with an egg. It's wonderful. It's a really nice demonstration. Anyway, that's what actually happened. Of course, what you see on the screen is me out there and Fred doing his demonstration. Then we move smoothly on to the next one. And there was a little cutaway to the audience to show how much they appreciated it, completely covering over the bit where I forgot completely what was supposed to happen. Other things that happen, I showed a script which had... Yep. Puma cub, it says. Okay, for the last lecture we were talking about the markings on animals. And we thought, right, what we want... We started out with the idea we wanted a tiger cub, but we couldn't find tiger cub anywhere. And a friend of mine found a place down in Dartmoor, Plymouth, Dartmoor Wildlife Park, had a baby puma. Now, adult pumas don't have any very striking markings, but baby pumas are spotty. So we drove down to Dartmoor Wildlife Park, which is about 210 miles, one day, spent 2 hours playing with the baby puma and also looking at some rather nice Siberian tigers, but they're 2 years old and a bit big and they wouldn't allow them into the lecture room anyway and they'd probably eat the lecturer. So we sort of fixed out these pumas, but at the back of our minds was still this idea that what we really wanted was a tiger, because the title of the last lecture was Fearful Symmetry, which of course is a Blake quote. It's from his poem that begins, Tiger, Tiger. We even had Blake's handwritten poem with a drawing of a tiger in the final verse. So it was just too good to miss if we could open with a real tiger. And about a week before we recorded, turned out there was a tiger available. In fact, there were two tiger cubs. And you could have two. There was the sort of briefcase-sized job, which was about a couple of months old, nice, cuddly, lots of cuddle factor, non-threatening tiger cub. And then there was the kind of suitcase-sized job, rather bit bigger than a retriever, which was 6.5 months old, weighed 6 stone, tigress. So we said, OK, we'll go for the cuddly one. And on the morning of the actual recording, we got a phone call saying, we're bringing the other one. And all of our plans had been based on the idea the tiger cub was sort of about this size and you'd carry it on. And suddenly it's this big, and it's on a lead, and there's two people, and all of this. So quick rethink. And they assured us that this was the right decision, that there were very good reasons why this was the right tiger to have. And indeed, they were correct, because this was a professional, this tiger. It could actually come into a lecture room with 400 people in it and sort of look around, look at the cameras and the lights, and say, oh, yeah, fine, okay, you know, I'm used to this, and do its thing. Whereas the baby one would have been out of your arms and up in among the audience within about 10 seconds. So they were right, but it caused a lot of... We had to remove all the kids from the front row of seats and have the seats empty because the safety officer who checked it all out quite rightly said, look, the regulations are there must be a barrier between the animal and the audience. So those seats will be the barrier. He was very helpful. He tried to find a way to do it, but we had to completely change the whole thing in between, really, the dress rehearsal and the final lecture, the actual lecture. We had about 2 hours there to rethink all of that. So that's the kind of thing that happens. Other kind of thing that happens is the kids are a little bit too helpful, and I vividly remember dear little Jeremy. We were playing, it was a probability lecture, and we were playing Don't Get the Goat, which was a game show with three doors and a car behind one door and goats, which are booby prizes, behind the other door. And little Jeremy comes down and is told to choose a door. Now, the next stage is supposed to be marking the door he's chosen but not opening it, and opening a different door to reveal a goat and offering him the chance of changing his mind. Before we could quite get to that, he opened his door. He had, in fact, found the car. That didn't matter that much, but that was, we broke the rules. We stopped there. Immediate, hurried conference. Do it all again. So little Jeremy is sent back, close all the doors, reshuffle the car, bring little Jeremy down. He knows what to do now. Sort of instant rehearsal. And of course, all you see on the edited version is the second run through where he doesn't very helpfully open the door a little bit too soon. But, I mean, everyone collapsed when it happened. It was so funny. Because The most spectacular version of that was the teapot. Lecture number 5, the final lecture, 48 hours before we were due to record it, it suddenly dawned on us that firstly we were a little bit light of material and might run short, which is the big sin. Too long, you can cut it. Too short, you can't expand it. So you have to expand it beforehand. So we were sitting there brainstorming, and we suddenly started thinking time reversal, time travel, time, symmetries in time, let's do time. And then we then put together, there was a time tunnel, which was one of these kids' play tunnels, which was brought in from friend of the producers and then painted white at one end and black at the other. It was a nice red tunnel when it came in. By the time we finished with it, it was black and white. Because we wanted a black hole and a white hole and stick them together to get a wormhole. Okay, and we had this great idea for time reversal, that we would get a kid to smash the famous and very valuable Royal Institution teapot, which we'd gone out and bought 6 of that morning. And in fact, these children are not rehearsed in any way, but the producer's son did a really good job. Okay, so the producer's young son was drummed in and let in on the joke. So he's given this teapot to hold, and he juggles with it and drops it, smash, you see. And then we say, don't worry, the universe is time reversible, the laws of physics are time reversible, we will put it back together. We're filming this thing with a camera, and on the spot they can just show up on the screen a reversed shot of the whole thing. So instead of fragments, instead of the thing hitting the floor, smashing into fragments, the fragments on the floor scuttle together and leap into the air as a reconstituted teapot on the screen. Okay, so that's the plan. Well, at rehearsal we found one of the problems with the plan. It's a wooden floor. And teapots are made not to smash when you drop them. And the first brand of teapot simply refused to smash almost completely. I mean, you could pick it up and go like that, and then it would smash. But that was about all you could do. So we got rid of that, and they went out and spent another 150 quid on 6 more teapots and experimented and discovered those smashed pretty well. Okay, so we're doing this, and so young Sam, producer's son, juggles this thing, drops it, and he hits the floor, and a bit of the handle chips off, and that's it. So we decided we'd try again. So we got rid of that one. Try again with the next one. Exactly the same thing happens. So then we go to plan B. Plan B is when that happens, I have to get in on the act and I say, okay, well, if you're going to treat the Royal Institution teapot like that, you might as well do a really good job of it. And I have an excuse to actually throw it at the floor. So I did, and it bounced. On the third attempt, it actually smashed. At that point, we're back in the groove. But if you watch that lecture, when that teapot smashes, there is an enormous burst of applause from the audience. And the reason is, we spent 10 minutes trying to smash that thing. After that, it was plain sailing. The other bit of the story is that Sam, again, is given a little polythene bag with all the bits and pieces of the teapot, goes through the time tunnel and emerges at the other end carrying a complete whole teapot. You know, number 5 of the teapots that we had bought is hidden in the tunnel, and Sam knows what to do. So that's the kind of game we ended up having to play when we were actually making the thing. So there's an awful lot more goes on behind the scenes. There are other problems. The BBC, you realise you're doing it, and other lecturers have said this to me, you finally realise it's real when you turn up outside the Royal Institution and there's 3 dirty great big BBC outside broadcast vans sitting in a row and cables everywhere. And we had the broadcast vans, we had cables, and there were builders who had been working on the outside of the building for about the last 3 years, and there was scaffolding up. And scaffolding was great for tying the cables to, so the BBC tied all its cables to the scaffolding. So, on the morning of Lecture 3 being recorded, the builders decided it was a great time to take the scaffolding down. Now, my theory is that they were onto a good thing here, you know, a few hundred quid from the BBC to leave it up, and they were in business, but they really wanted to take it down. So, in fact, they were persuaded not to take it down until we'd recorded that one. And then during the rehearsal for the next one, they took all the scaffolding down and the BBC were relaying all these cables. So that's going on as well. So there are layers and layers of this. The amazing thing really is that this kind of event ever gets put together. But it happened. It worked. You can buy the video. You can buy the booklet. You can buy the video pack. And, of course, the BBC are busy thinking about the next one. I'm not. What is now occupying my mind rather more is the fact that in August in Japan, we do the whole thing again. And in Japan, we do all 5 lectures in 2.5 days. 1 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon, 1 in the morning, 1 in the afternoon, 1 in the morning. That's it. The theory is that by then we all know what we're doing. The dreadful truth is, by then we've probably forgotten what we're doing. We have to learn it all over again. But I'm sure it'll be great fun. Okay, I'm going to stop talking there and invite questions from anyone who wishes to ask any kind of question. There are two rules, I will say this. You can ask any question you like. Rule 1. Rule 2, I don't have to answer if I don't want to. Okay, anyone got any questions? Gentleman at the back.
Ah. I'm going to have a teapot which is known
for the
fracture.
It will probably be a Japanese teapot. What we're trying to do, they crate up a whole pile of these demonstrations and actually ship them out to Japan months ahead. But anything that can be got locally, they get locally if they can. Things like the Tiger, we can't really ship our Tiger out. So it could be there's a Japanese zoo or something's got a tiger. It could be it turns into a mongoose instead, or a raccoon, or anything that's got stripes. It could be we have to rewrite the script and have something that's got spots instead, whatever. For the teapot, I imagine we'll get the teapots locally, and somebody will experiment and try to get nice, fragile teapots. Or it will be a sake jug or something a little more Japanese. And we kind of make it up as we go along. That's the way they try and handle this. So it will be a version of the lectures, but there will be a lot of changes made on the ground in a few days beforehand.
2.5 days actually filming. What's the lead time?
The lead time in Japan for us is only about 3 days. for Japanese to mess around with things and for us to play around with a few possibilities is probably longer. We can get some advance warning, but actually on the ground, 3 days. Yeah. It's very intensive. Even with the BBC here, it was pretty much 12 hours a day for 10 days. That's quite nice. So. Yes, I think what they're going to do, for the studio audience, they will have earphones and will get simultaneous translation into Japanese. For the television audience, they will dub over the top. Yeah. And we have no idea what they do with that. We have no idea. This is a standard thing. The Royal Institution have done this for about 10 years now. It always goes to Japan. It's even written into the contract that it goes to Japan. And whether what comes out of it is good Japanese television or dreadful Japanese television, they have no idea. They assume it's good because it's NHK, which is a pretty good Japanese television company. But who can tell? You'd have to ask a Japanese. Yeah. I think so. A lot of it was more to do with the whole business of simplifying things or presenting things in a clear way. I could now go away and rewrite that book. In a sense, that version of the book is not, it's not meant to be the book of the lectures. It's meant to be a companion aimed at a deeper level, at a more adult audience, whatever. But if I could now probably go away and write a book that would be aimed at the same 11 to 16 year old audience that is at the lectures, it wouldn't be a copy of the lectures in any way. But the approach to simplifying it, making the thing more accessible, we started out with the idea we knew how to do that. And by the time we finished, we decided we actually knew rather better how to do that. You've got a much clearer idea what works, what doesn't. So I think that's perhaps the main thing that came out of it in that regard. Various odd bits and pieces. People would come up. After it's over, the audience gets to come up and hover around and ask a few questions. And it's amazing what you suddenly get told. Somebody out there is an expert on something. You know, we were talking about boa constrictors. We had a boa constrictor in there. And there's someone in the audience who's an expert on boa constrictors and afterwards comes and tells you the real story, all about it. And so you certainly learn things like that as well. And preparing it, we learned all sorts of things. We had a genuine Babylonian clay tablet from about 500 BC of measurements of Jupiter. And two people from the British Museum came with it. They didn't quite carry machine guns, but they stood over it. But talking to them about these clay tablets was very interesting. You don't often get a chance to do that. And down at the wildlife park, which in the end we didn't use their puma, but we had a lovely time talking to them. We're going to go back anyway and talk to them because we just learned so much about the animals. So all sorts of spin-off like that. Yeah. Oh, sorry, yeah.
Were you worried about
children
and animals?
Well, this is what they say, don't work with children or animals, don't they? And you work with both. It's worse than that. It's even worse for the person he's worst for is actually the TV director, who is working with children and animals and an amateur, me, who's even worse. And he's got six cameras, and he not only has to know his script and switch from camera to camera at the right moment, but he has to recognise when I've gone wrong and work out what to do. So he's up there improvising. But oddly enough, the children and the animals behave beautifully. We really had no trouble with the children or the animals. In fact, the story of the teapot, I think, exemplifies the most important principle, which the floor manager, who's been doing this for, I think, 30 years, said to me quite early on. He said, the complicated things always work. It's the really simple things that go wrong. Yes, it's the hose falling off the tap. It's the teapot that doesn't smash. It's things you absolutely convinced cannot possibly go wrong. That's what goes wrong. So I was a bit nervous about working with children and animals, but the kids make the show and so do the animals. The tiger stole the entire final lecture, and that's what she was for. She was lovely. She came in. We had her around most of the day, and we kept bringing her into the lecture room for a few minutes to get used to it, and then taking her out, and then more and more people in. And eventually we had 100 people in the audience and brought her in. People looked around. At one point, got her up on the desk, and she knocked all the mathematical objects off the desk and things and played with them. It was a Daily Telegraph reporter who wanted a photograph, so we stuck her on the desk for him to get a nice photograph. And she started drinking my water from the jug. that was nice. So, yep, no problem with the kids and the animals. Sorry, yes. No, there's a lady over here next. Yes, sir. Anyone? Somewhere over there?
Is there something you're really sorry you have to?
Yes. One thing we left out, we put it in the lecture and then it got taken out again. We had, in the probability lecture, we had a very brief discussion of BSE and the implications of probability and risk for BSE, which is very topical, and the producer really wanted it in, and the man from Wellcome Foundation, which was sponsoring the whole thing, after the lecture said, "I'm so pleased you put that stuff about BSE in." And then we cut it out, because the lecture was 15 minutes too long, and we had to get rid of it again. So that was one thing. That was very much on the... That lecture particularly had a few fairly serious items. We had the Challenger shuttle disaster as well. We had a picture of the thing blowing up on the screen. And the atmosphere in the lecture room when you see this happening is very striking. It's everyone, complete silence. We had to break the mood. So as well as that, we had a story that was improvised 2 days before with two stuffed toy cats and a crime had been committed, which is based on what happens at our house every day in the morning, which is one cat's idea of eating breakfast is you turn your nose up at it, come back half an hour later and then eat a little bit and come back half an hour later. But the other cat's idea of breakfast is anything that's around, you scoff it. So the first cat turns its back on its bowl. And what we actually have to do is immediately grab the bowl and tuck it away on top of the microwave so the other cat can't get it. But if we don't, it's just gone. So we reconstructed this thing with toy cats and bowls and things, partly in order to get a contrast to the rather serious aspect of the Challenger disaster. What else did we leave out? There was something that on paper looked really... really nice, really worth doing, really felt, hey, this is a great idea. And then we couldn't get hold of whatever it was that we were supposed to get hold of. And it was something stupid. I'm sorry, I can't remember what it was. But it was one of these silly things where 48 hours beforehand, you think, that's great, that'll go, it's still in the script. We'll just send someone out to buy the whatever it is that we need. And they go out to buy it, and you can't get it. And nowhere in London, nowhere, anywhere can we find whatever it was. I can't actually remember. Sorry about that. Lady there. Sorry? Okay, where do the children come from? They come from a variety of sources. They're not screened. What happens is the Royal Institution, firstly, it has some very standard schools and other organisations it sends out information to, and they buy tickets. It has regulars who come along every year. It also sells tickets to anyone who wants to turn up and get them. So it's a variety of sources, but probably half of it is a kind of standard captive audience. It tends to be local schools where there's a keen teacher who gets the kids to come and so forth. When they arrive, they're just basically, as they come in, they're segregated into children and the rest. And the children fill up the seats that the television cameras can see, and the rest are put in the remaining seats. Then for choosing children to volunteer, almost always, probably about 90% of the time, they are simply unprepared volunteers, whichever one. You have to pick someone who it's fairly easy for them to get out. They tend to be on the end of a row or something like that. For one or two of the demonstrations, I think no more than about 5 in total, where it was a bit complicated, we felt it was unfair on the children to expect them to do it on the spot. And so about half an hour beforehand, a couple of them however many were needed, were quickly rehearsed on this, and I was simply told, okay, it's the two on the end of that row. So you still ask the volunteers, and they still want to put your hands up, but then my job is to pick the right one. This is one of the extra worries you have. You're giving your lecture, you're trying to remember what you're going to say, you're trying to remember what comes next. And then one or two other, you're trying to make sure you're standing in the right place. If I'm standing here, that's fine, the camera knows that. If I'm standing here, it doesn't work properly. So I actually have to stand in, for certain things, I have to stand in exactly the right places. So you have to remember that. And you have to remember whether this is one of those things where you can pick any kid who's volunteered, or whether this is the one where there's a ringer in the audience, you've got to pick the right one. So in practice that worked, but it certainly was a bit fraught trying to remember all of it. But we tried not to cheat with the volunteers, but we wanted to be fair on them. And there are one or two quite complicated things. The pantomime animal, where we teach the kids to make certain kinds of animal movements. And they never really get the walking elephant right. That's fine. We rather expected that. We're certainly happy to settle for that. It's there for comedy routine as much as anything. But what the pattern that they should be getting is established in the audience's mind anyway, because they're being told to do it. And the reason they don't get it right is because we didn't rehearse them on that. We just grabbed two kids and stuff them in this thing that starts out as a camel, turns into a horse. It's got a camel's head on. You take the camel's head off, put on a horse's head. Then take the horse's head off, put an elephant's head on. The elephant's head kept falling off in rehearsals. We had to get a pair of scissors out and rapidly change it. Yeah. How are we doing? I think time for another one. If I was the Minister of Education for one day, would I change how maths is taught in secondary schools? That's a very good question. Okay. Let me think about that. First, it's probably a good thing if I'm not Minister of Education for one day. I think I would like... I don't want to teach teachers how to do their job. The first thing I'd like to do is get teachers back to teaching. So, okay, I would abolish all of the paperwork that teachers have to fill in so that they can get back to teaching. The career track for maths teachers tends to be that for one reason or another, in order for the school to keep them, they have to promote them. The only way they can promote them is turn them into a head of department or a head teacher. If they turn them to head of department or head teacher, they don't teach as much maths anymore, possibly none at all. I remember years ago talking to someone from, I think, Surly Hull, local education authority, saying, if all the maths teachers we got in the schools were actually teaching maths, we wouldn't have a problem. But they nearly all have masters. So there's a sort of career track, which it's probably because the maths teachers could handle the accounts. You know, which these days is a big part of being a head teacher. I'm sure it's balancing your budget. You know, you're in control of things a lot more. But so that's one thing I'd do. Secondly, I think... I don't know how to handle this, but the great pity about teaching maths at school is it's so hard, and it is really a difficult subject. Even the kids who are good at maths find it quite hard at times. That, you know, it's not all plain sailing, even for the good ones. And for everyone else, it's a real pain. So most of the effort goes into making sure they really can do it and get the answers right, which means you don't get as much time to enjoy it. If you're playing a sport and every time you're starting to learn to play tennis and you never get to play a game because you're not getting the shot right. Yes? You try to serve the ball, it goes over the net, it is actually a perfectly legitimate shot, but before the other person can hit it back to you to have a game, you're stopped and say, no, sorry, technique's not right there, do it again. And you spend all day trying to serve the ball. That's not much fun. And I think some of our teaching of maths is like that. But I don't know what the answer is, because it is actually rather important to get the... unless you can get some grounding in these techniques, you can't go any further. So that's another thing. What else? I think the current moves towards getting rid of calculators and things like that early on is a good idea. I'm perfectly prepared to be told that this is nonsense and... I'm just an old fogey on this, but Hong Kong and Singapore, from which we get quite a few students, are always very, very good. And I think it's not just because they're the ones that come overseas. There is a good tradition of maths in those countries. The schools there forbid calculators full stop completely throughout the entire time kids are at school. And it means horrible routine things like they have to learn their tables, but it also means that a certain amount of technique is at their fingertips. Calculators are great if you know how to do it without a calculator, then it's, you can use one. It's one of those silly things. Our first year students will spend an awful lot of time learning certain mathematical techniques and being very, very careful about them, and we absolutely insist they get them. And the day one of your students has really got this technique and you're absolutely convinced they've understood it, you sort of pull them off to one side and say, oh, by the way, you don't need to use it anymore. You've proved to me you can do it, so now you don't have to. Now you can be sloppy. You've earned the right to be sloppy. I know you'll get the right answer by being sloppy, but I wanted to see you could do it right first. And so I think calculators are a bit similar. You earn the right to use them by showing that you don't need them. Once you've proved you don't need them, then you're allowed to have them. The only thing that worries me about that argument, I remember vividly being forced to use a dip pen and an inkwell to write at school. Now, this is back in the days when the only thing... You didn't have ballpoint pens, at least. Ballpoint pens were only just coming in. They were still rather frowned upon. The fountain pen was the thing you used. But it was much easier to write with a fountain pen than it was with this blasted dip pen. You pick it up, you're about to write something, and there's a blob of ink on your page. And it seemed rather silly at the time to force us to use difficult technology when something far superior was available. The argument was, you will learn to write better if you use a dip pen. Now, I have the uncomfortable feeling that my argument about calculators is a little bit close to that. And the extent to which it's close to that, I think it's questionable, because I don't think with the dip pen actually that was correct. It makes it so hard to learn, you don't learn good technique. That's the problem. Whereas if you start with a fountain pen, you could still teach good handwriting. My handwriting's dreadful, but I don't think it's anything to do with any of that. Right. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Let me give you some figures. The average audience for the last lot of Christmas lectures was 1.3 million. The maximum was 1.6 million. The makeup of that audience, a rather typical grouping of people, is granny and granddad and the teenagers and the three-year-old. And mum's out in the kitchen making lunch or whatever. And dad may or may not be in there. That's one quite typical grouping. There are huge numbers of people who just like watching. My wife watches Christmas lectures every year. There are lots of people who will do this. So the actual audience for the televised part is 9 to 90. It's almost anybody. And the lecturers know this. So... the one thing that saves it, I think, is at the back of your mind is a feeling that if I can produce a lecture that works with the live audience of, they say, 11 to 16-year-olds, but there were some 7-year-olds in the audience, certainly when I was doing it, and there are certainly some older than 16, but the core audience is 11 to 16. But if you come up with something that entertains and informs and works with 11 to 16-year-olds, it works with everyone. It is actually possible. In a sense, you don't have to worry too much about the broad audience. You don't do anything for them. They're going to get taken care of anyway. And I think because they know that the audience in the lecture is children, they aren't insulted if occasionally you say things in a slightly simple way. It's a very good excuse to talk to adults in a simple way. So, yes, the BBC, the lecturers, everybody is very conscious of the fact that the real audience out there is all ages. And, in fact, you're also conscious of the fact that primarily what you're doing is making a television programme. It used to be that primarily what the lecturer was doing was... Well, it used to be that all they were doing was giving a live lecture. Then it was they were giving a live lecture and the BBC filmed it. But then as television production standards got higher and higher and higher, and we all watch so much telly now that if there's anything... If a shot isn't centred quite right or is a little bit out of focus or something like that, you can't watch it. So the production side gets more and more emphasised, and it's now reached the point where really what's going on is the lecturer is making a TV programme, a series, and the audience, to some extent, are just another prop. You're trying to give the audience their good value, and on the other hand, you are going to do things which in a real lecture you would not do. You will actually stop and say, sorry, we're going to do that again. Now, whatever I was doing in a live lecture, I wouldn't do it that way. I might say, well, I made a bit of a mess of that. Here's how it should have gone, or whatever. But I won't do this rather formalised, stop, go back, start again. On the other hand, I don't think this is a big problem for the audience, because half the fun for the audience is watching what the cameras are doing, watching how the BBC make the television. So it's not as... You think you're trying to square the circle, and after a while you realise it doesn't matter. It's going to work anyway. It takes a couple of lectures to realise this. I think every lecturer has to realise it for themselves. The BBC can tell you any number of things, but there's no substitute for actually doing it. I have one more question, then I'll stop, because I don't want to keep everybody. Okay, the recording was 6 days before Christmas for lectures 1, 2, and 3. 4 days after Christmas for lectures 4 and 5. And, in fact, let me actually look up... I can almost quote you these figures from memory, but if I look it up in the diary, it'll give you an idea. The final lecture, we finished recording the final lecture roughly 16 hours before it was broadcast. And they spent about 8 hours after that editing it. So the last one gets pretty close. The first lecture was rehearsed on the 17th of December, recorded on the 18th. The next one was the 19th and 20th. The next was the 22nd and 23rd. There was a Sunday off in between. The fourth one was on the 28th and 29th. The fifth one was on the 30th and 31st. Number one was being transmitted when we were rehearsing lecture 4. Number two was transmitted while we were recording lecture 4. Number three was transmitted while we were rehearsing lecture 5. Number four was transmitted while we were recording lecture 5. And number five was transmitted the day after. So there's a sort of longish schedule of recording it, a tight schedule of broadcasting it, and they telescope into each other. And they always do it that way. There are various reasons why it has to be timed like that. You've got to have the lectures at the time the kids are not at school. So it has to sit around Christmas, but it can't actually go over Christmas itself. They're always televised just after Christmas. That's the slot. And so we have to work with that. Okay, thank you very much. I'll stop there and let you all get away. Thanks for coming. I'll turn myself off.